That special music, that was very nice. Now it's everybody's turn to stand up and sing. We'll be singing page 56, if you'll take your songbooks and rise. Sing Praises and Rejoice, page 56. Thank you. Please be seated. Now for the sermon once again, our pastor, Mr. Frank McCready.
All of you men get one of these? I hope you did. If you didn't, there's one waiting for you. Oh, you'll be passing them out after church also? Oh, okay. Well, so if you didn't get yours before church, you will be getting it. I've got it on good authority that you would be getting it after church, okay? I only brought this up, as you know, tomorrow is Father's Day. So it's a very nice gesture the church does for both Mother and Father's Day. I'm trying to figure out, without opening the package, what this box is. I'm a curious person. There's a little box in there, and it says men. A little bit too small to get men in there. Anyway, I'll have to check that out. At the church. By the way, mine is under the lectern. You can get your own. As I mentioned, when I got back from, my wife and I got back from Asia, we had the opportunity to have the ABC continuing education class. And they scheduled mine for 3 hours on Friday, since I would be getting in just shortly before then. And so I had the opportunity to be there with Dave and the Walters, and thoroughly enjoyed my 3 hours there. Anyone who teaches that week for continuing education, they ask the instructors to cover material that they cover in their class. You know, since I teach the harmony of the Gospels, they want me to cover material from the harmony of the gospel. So I was trying to figure out what to cover. A number of years ago, I covered the introduction to the harmony. And then I also covered, I think, the Beatitudes at that particular time. This time, I came up with the title, Lessons from the Harmony as Taught by Jesus Christ. And I had four that I was able to get through. I actually had six of them. I didn't tell them that. But I had six of them put together because I wasn't sure, never having given this before, whether I could get through two, three, four, five, or six. I made it through four of them. So I've got two more that I can use yet in the future for class. I just need to add a couple more to it. But the first one I covered is fundamental to all the rest. It's foundational, really, to our entire lives. And that's why I had it first. Now, Mr. Hensley and Mr. and Mrs. Walters are going to have a review here today. No, you cannot go home. I want to discuss with you the first lesson that I covered in the continuing education class. After covering it, I thought, you know, this would be really good for a sermon because it's, again, foundational and fundamental for really our entire lives, and all of the other lessons that I would bring forth teaching the harmony of the gospel, or any other of the men who teach would bring forth in their classes, is fundamental to everything. And that first lesson, two words, and I'll give it to you in a minute, just two words. Turn with me to Matthew chapter 17. This is where we take and get the two words for the first lesson taught by Jesus Christ and our Heavenly Father. It's in John chapter 17. And we'll begin, Matthew chapter 17. And we'll begin reading in verse 1. Matthew 17, verse 1. Has to do with what is commonly known as the Transfiguration. It says, "Now after 6 days, Jesus took Peter, James, and John his brother, led them up to a high mountain by themselves, and he was transfigured before them." This vision took place. If you read the next chapter, you'll see where Christ calls it a vision. Okay, they have this vision that they're seeing there on the mountain. "And he was transfigured before them. His face shone like the sun. His clothing became as white as the light." Basically giving them an idea of what it is to be like as a spirit being. What all of us as spirit beings one day can be like. "Behold, Moses and Elijah appeared to them, talking with them." So there's this vision of Moses and Elijah. "And Peter answered and said to Jesus, 'Lord, is it good for us to even be here? If you wish, let us make three tabernacles, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah.' And while he was still speaking, behold, a bright cloud overshadowed them. And suddenly a voice came out of heaven saying, 'This is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased. This is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased.'" Now you may remember that same statement was made at the time Jesus Christ was baptized. Not that he had to be baptized. He had never sinned, but he did it as an example for us. A voice came out of heaven basically saying the same thing. Now, the lesson that the gospel teaches, Jesus himself being there through the Transfiguration as well as the Father, two words. Let's read them. "This is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased. Hear him." Hear him. Now, as I told the ABC students, it's not a matter, and I think I've mentioned it here in the past too, it's not a matter of hear him. Oh, he's got a good tenor voice. What a baritone. I've never heard a bass like that in my life. You know, he would carry an entire bass section. It's so good. Hear him. The word in the Greek is ekouete. And I'm anglicizing it. It's A-K-O-U-E-T-E, for those of you who like Greek words. A-K-O-U-E-T-E. And it does mean to hear him, but also means to listen to him, to pay close attention to him, and to obey. So when it says hear him, it's much more than just, okay, I heard his voice. Yeah, I heard him. Hear him, according to the Greek, means to listen intently, to obey. And if you go and read Deuteronomy chapter 18, this is kind of a spinoff from that, Deuteronomy chapter 18, because we have a similar statement made there. Turn back there with me to Deuteronomy chapter 18. Thank you. So the Greek ekouete means don't just hear him, but listen to him. It's translated not merely hearing, but obeying what is heard. You come to Deuteronomy chapter 18, and we'll begin our reading in verse 15. In this chapter, principles governing kings, those who are in positions of responsibility, are given, this section 17 and 18. It talks about not following those things that are an abomination. In other words, the laws of God are given through Moses. And you come down to verse 15 of chapter 18. It says, "The Lord your God will raise up a prophet like unto me." Moses telling him, look, there's going to come a prophet raised up like unto me. And he's going to be raised up in your midst. Now, we know that didn't happen during the time of Moses. It didn't happen during, you know, the time of the kings. It didn't happen during, you know, the time of David. It didn't happen during the time of the prophets that followed. But it did eventually happen, you know, centuries and centuries later. David was a man after God's own heart, but he wasn't that prophet. He was a prophet, but he wasn't the one who was going to be raised up like unto Moses. Moses was used to do what? Obviously lead the children of Israel out of Egypt, but also to give the law to God, to give the law to the people by God. God used him to pass on spiritual lessons, the Ten Commandments, and all the spin-offs, you know, the judgments that come into play from them, how to apply you know, those laws. All that came from Moses. And it's obviously prophesying Jesus Christ. That's who's being referenced here. "He will raise up a prophet like unto me from your midst, from your brethren. Him shall you hear." If you go down to verse 18, it says, "A prophet like you from among your brethren, and will put my words in his mouth." So we see here in Deuteronomy chapter 18 a very similar statement. Him shall you hear. Now Christ came like Moses, and he came, and what did Jesus Christ do with the law? The world will tell you he did what with it. He abrogated it, specifically the Sabbath. But what did Jesus Christ really do to the law? He magnified it. You know, he magnified the law. Isaiah brings it out quite readily. He embellished the law. He made it really more binding when you understand it. It says, "Thou shalt not kill." Christ says, "You shall not hate." Right? I might not want to shoot somebody, but I may find it easier hating that person, right? And God says, no, you don't do that either. Matter of fact, when you follow that law to its farthest, it's thou shalt not murder, thou shalt not hate, thou shalt love. Take the spirit of the law that Christ came to give us, to amplify the Ten Commandments. It goes all the way out to love. Matter of fact, to reinforce this point, the word here for him shall you hear, the word hear is the word shema, S-H-A-M-A, in the Hebrew. And according to Strong's, it means to hear intelligently. So it's being applied to Christ. Him shall you hear intelligently. Often with the implication of attention. Strong attention to what's being stated. You aren't sitting there yawning and dazing and falling asleep. You're attuned. You're in tune with what you're looking him in the eyes and you're shaking your head. You're paying close attention to what he has to say. That's what it means. And then it also means, as you pay attention, the implication is then you would follow that which you are hearing. Hear him. Follow him. Brown, Drivers, and Briggs for Shema says to hear, to listen with attention, to listen with interest, to obey, to be obedient. The Word Study Dictionary. In other words, I want you to get the point of what's being stated here. The Word Study Dictionary for Shema says a verb meaning to hear, to obey, and to listen intently. And then the Theological Word Book of the Old Testament for Shema says hear, listen to, obey, also be attentive and give attention to what is being stated. So, you know, all of the commentaries are dictionaries bring out that reality. You know, the Hebrew, Greek dictionaries. Him shall you hear. Him shall you pay attention to. Turn over with me to Hebrews chapter 1. So the first of life when it comes to Jesus Christ is hearing. Hear what he had to say. After all, was he not the one that God used to inspire the writing of all the Bible? So would you not say it's fundamental in everything we do and understand? Hear what he has to say. In Hebrews chapter 1, this reality is brought forth. Now the book of Hebrews has some doctrine in it, but the book of Hebrews is primarily for doctrine. The book of Hebrews is to educate the Hebrews, the Jewish people, as to who the Messiah is, okay, and his greatness. Because we know the Jews, even up to today, do not accept, I should say every single one, we do have Jews in the church, as a matter of fact, but Judaism as a whole does not accept Jesus Christ as the Messiah. They think he was a good person. Some will even say he was a prophet. But they will not accept him for the position that he actually holds, the Messiah, you know, the Lord, our soon coming King. But they don't accept that. So the writer of Hebrews, and I believe it was Paul, says, God, who at various times and in various ways spoke in times past to the fathers by the prophets. You know, God often raised up prophets to pass on knowledge and understanding to often the fathers, the leaders. And God allowed these prophets, Peter says, under inspiration. He allowed them to write their books based upon their own personalities, their own likes and their dislikes, who they are, what they felt about themselves. They were allowed to be who they were and then write from that perspective. But under inspiration, God wanted, you know, what they gave was for our benefit. And sometimes it's the good, sometimes it's the bad, sometimes it's the ugly. You know, sometimes it's in a rotten attitude. I mean, David was a man after God's heart. Have you ever read some of his prayers? Have you read some of them? My prayers would be, paraphrase would be, they're out to get me, Father. Kill them all. You read that in there sometimes, right? Get them. I'm on your side. Well, then you realize that the day was taking the hit. And often when you have trials, you've got to take the hit. And then you begin the process. Okay? If you read where he talks about doing the men, later on in that chapter he talks about blessing them. In other words, he brings himself around by communicating with God and getting his mind right with God, right? Have any of you ever felt like, I really wish so-and-so would be dealt with? No show of hands, please. And then later on, you realize, you know, that's not the right spirit, not the right frame of mind. You're reading, you say, you know, God says I should pray for my enemies and not curse them, you know, etc. But David sometimes told how he felt. Then he got himself where he needed to be. Okay? So these writers were allowed to write based upon who they were, under inspiration. But it goes on to say in Hebrews, as God did in various ways in times past speak to the fathers by the prophets, has in these last days spoken to us by His Son, whom He has appointed heir of all things, through whom He also made the worlds. Now, that is telling us, again, the greatness of Jesus Christ. Paul goes on and compares Christ to the angels, showing that the angels who were looked upon very highly. He's also dealing with the subject of Gnosticism. That's a whole other subject, because Gnosticism, they often, you know, the Gnostics often worship the spirit, angels in the spirit realm and so on. And, you know, it's a huge, huge subject. So Paul's dealing with that as well. And he's talking about the angels. God didn't say that the angels sit at my right hand side, but he did say to Jesus Christ, sit at my right hand side. And so he spoke to us, and we are to do what? What's the lesson? Go ahead, don't be afraid. Hear him! Exactly. Hear him. That's the lesson. Hear him. Pay attention to what he says. God's now speaking to us through him. And you find that if you turn back to Matthew chapter 5, that while Jesus was here on earth, he gave phenomenal instruction to those who would later be his apostles, and also those later who would follow Christ because of his writings and the writings of the apostles, those of us sitting here in Dayton on this particular Sabbath. So Jesus Christ did have many things that he wrote that amplified the law that he gave. As a matter of fact, the Sermon on the Mount, deals with one of the most phenomenal messages ever given. And I don't want to go through the Beatitudes in the Sermon on the Mount, but I do want to look at two verses. And these two verses, if you really understand them, will help you grasp the significance of just what the Beatitudes, and more specifically, the Sermon on the Mount is. And this is information given to us directly by whom? Jesus Christ. Who now God speaks to us via Him, not just through the prophets. And when you read the first two verses, you can just pass over what is being stated here very easily, especially if you don't understand the Greek and some Jewish tradition. Okay? And that would probably be the case with most of us. I didn't fully understand this until I started teaching the harmony. And I started digging into material so as to be able to present material to the class. And I began to dig in, and I came across this material in the first two verses, and I thought, wow. Wow. It makes the Beatitudes and Sermon on the Mount that much greater in my mind. So let's read the first two verses, and we'll go back and look at three items. Words from Jesus Christ. Hear Him. And seeing the multitudes, verse 1, He went up on a mountain, and when He was seated, His disciples came to Him. Then He opened His mouth, and He taught them, saying. Now, we read that and say, okay, He sat down, He taught them. And you would be correct. But there's much more to it than that. There's a greater impact when you understand what is being stated here. Seeing the crowds, Jesus went up in the mountain, and when He sat down, His disciples came to Him, and He opened His mouth, and He taught them. Jesus understood, and those living at that time understood, that when a Jewish rabbi was teaching officially, he sat to teach. He sat to teach. Now, that doesn't mean that rabbis, when they walked around and they had their students with them, didn't open their mouth and potentially pass on good things. But when they were wanting to teach officially, they were wanting to give pertinent information, they did it sitting. Okay, that was just the way they did it. Okay, the Jewish rabbi was teaching officially when he sat to teach. Now, Ron and Carolyn and Dave have the answer to this, so they are not allowed to give the answer. But today, and more so when I was younger and in college, they spoke of an instructor, and when he was teaching, they talked of it as the what? Anybody know? They called it the professor's. Anybody remember? They called it the professor's chair. Very good. In other words, whenever he was teaching officially, or he had a position or responsibility to teach, that professor, they said it was the professor's chair. It was known as teaching from a seated position. Now, we're not all Catholics. I used to be, grew up in Catholicism. But even within the Catholic Church, you have the Pope, when he's giving official teaching and something that is considered to be infallible, he does it from where? From the throne, from his seat on the throne. It's called ex cathedra. You ever heard that term? When the Pope speaks ex cathedra, nobody can contradict him. It's almost like God Himself is speaking. But it only is ex cathedra when he's seated in his chair. And that's considered the official teaching. So the very intimation that Jesus Christ sat down, and that's emphasized here, sat down to teach His disciples, is the indication that His teaching is central and official and very important. It's something that's going to be coming forth that you need to pay close attention to. Okay? That's what it comes forth from Jewish tradition as well as teaching from the Greek. Now, you may not realize it, that Jesus was considered a rabbi, by those at that time. He was considered a rabbi. And so when He sat to teach, He was teaching officially. He was teaching that which is important. Now, Matthew goes on to say that when He had opened His mouth, He taught them. The phrase, opened His mouth, again, according to the Greek, is not simply a decorative, roundabout way of saying He said something. He opened his mouth in the Greek is very important. As a matter of fact, I got this from Barclay. In Greek, the phrase has a double significance. He opened his mouth. In Greek, it is used of a solemn, grave, and dignified utterance. Opening his mouth is used of a solemn, grave, and dignified utterance. It's used, for instance, of the saying of an important person, someone like an oracle. It is the natural preface in a sentence for a most weighty saying. So when he sat down to teach officially, he now opened his mouth. He's giving you what? Weighty, important instruction, material that is of importance and that should be paid close attention to. It's grave, solemn, and dignified. It also, in the Greek, means that the person who is doing the uttering is really opening his heart and fully pouring out his mind. Those are the two elements that are involved with the open his mouth. It's a very solemn, grave, dignified utterance. It carries great weight, and the person is really opening his heart and fully pouring out his mind. In other words, it is used of intimate teaching with no barriers between. And that's what Jesus Christ was doing. Giving official teaching that was weighty, it was solemn. He was opening up his heart to give forth really important information and knowledge. So when it says, hear him, that's what he means. Pay attention. Be in tune. Be willing to follow the instruction that you are given. So it is the grave and solemn utterance of central things. It is the opening of Jesus' heart and mind to the men who were to be his right-hand men for the task he was giving to them. And then, by extension, to all of us. To all of us. And thirdly, talking about hear him, when it says he opened his mouth, it also says he taught them saying. Now, how many here were really good at English? Anyone? Anyone good at English? I usually don't get too many hands on that. English and grammar, Math and science? I raised my hand on that one. Yeah, did pretty well with math and science. My wife kept her hand down. My wife was very good at English and grammar. She says math and science wasn't something she really liked, but my wife is known by my children as the grammar Nazi. She doesn't mind my sharing that with you. It was cute. You know, they can be discussing something somewhat important. If they don't have correct subject verb agreement, she'll stop them and make sure they do it correctly. And my son, was it Rick, sweetheart, or Scotty who sent you that cartoon? It was my son Rick. Sent it to the entire family, knowing that we all would just love it. Even my wife broke down laughing. You may not find it as funny as we, but we have our grammar Nazi. But he sent us this cartoon, and it goes all the way back to Egypt. You've got the Egyptian garb on, and this guy's got the chisel and the hammer, and he's chiseling away, and he's got the hieroglyphic, he's got those up there, hieroglyphics. And you got this guy behind him shaking his head, and he says, come on now, everyone knows you don't end a sentence with a bird. My son sat to us and says, underneath it, he wrote down, Mom in her former life. Mom in her former life. So, taught them saying. Taught, in the Greek, there are two past tense of the verb. There's the aorist tense, which you possibly heard a little bit about when you were in school. The aorist tense expresses one particular action that's done and completed in past time. For instance, he shut the gate. It was just done. Past tense, it was done. He shut the gate. It would be in the aorist in the Greek because it describes one completed action in the past. Then there's the imperfect tense. Anybody remember the imperfect tense? No one. Oh, we got one. There is the imperfect tense, and the imperfect tense describes repeated, continuous, habitual action in the past. It is past tense, but it means it's continuous, habitual action in the past. In this sentence, it was his custom to go to church every Sabbath, as his custom was. Okay, in Greek, it was his custom to go would be expressed by a single word, a single verb in the imperfect tense, because it describes continuous and often repeated action in the past. It was something that was continually done. Okay. Now, the point is that the Greek in this sentence, which we're looking at right now, the verb taught is not aorist, but it's imperfect. Therefore, when it says he taught them, it describes repeated and habitual action, and the translation should be, this is what he used to teach them regularly. That's important to note. In other words, Jesus Christ just didn't give the Sermon on the Mount and the Beatitudes and say, one and done. This was something he habitually, continually taught them. It was that important. And as you go through the harmony of the Gospel, the four books, you'll find Jesus, when he talked with his disciples, or those who may not be his disciples, often something from the Sermon on the Mount, the Beatitudes, is coming forth. So, we are being taught now, today, taught by the prophets, but today he's spoken to us by his Son, Jesus Christ, and we are to do what? Hear him. Pay attention. So Matthew has said, as plainly as the Greek will allow, that the Sermon on the Mount is not one sermon that Jesus Christ gave. It's one subject that Jesus continuously and habitually taught his disciples. And so we today read it, and we should also be learning from it and applying it regularly. Now Barclay says, the Sermon on the Mount is greater than even we think. Matthew, in his introduction, wishes us to see that is the official teaching of Jesus, that is the opening of Jesus' whole mind to his disciples. It is a summary of the teachings which Jesus habitually gave to his inner circle. The Sermon on the Mount is nothing less than the concentrated memory of many hours of heart-to-heart communication between Jesus Christ and his disciples. So, hear him is important. And hopefully you can understand just by two very simple verses that you would overlook, because you want to get to the heart of the message, right? I want to get to the Sermon on the Mount. I want to get to the Beatitudes. Well, you need to understand the importance of it. And just those two sentences. You know, he sat down, official teaching. He opened his mouth, waiting, coming from the heart, and he taught them continuously, regularly, this material. So we should understand and fully grasp, again, the significance of what is involved here. Turn to 1 John chapter 2. There's a word here I want to look at, and then we'll jump over to John 15. But in 1 John chapter 2, verse 1 gives you our MO. Okay? This is our MO. John writes, my little children, these things I write to you so that you may not sin. That's our MO, is it not? We all want to live our lives and not sin. How many have done that perfectly from the time you were baptized? I don't think too many of you have. I doubt if anyone in here has. I can't raise my hand. But that's my MO, that's your MO. We try to serve God to the best of our ability. And at times we might get a little out of control, get upset and angry and say something we shouldn't, etc. And so John covers that too. I write that you don't sin. But if anyone sins, and he kind of knew they probably would, we have an advocate with the Father, Jesus Christ, the righteous. And he himself is the propitiation or the forgiveness of our sins, and not only for ours, but also the whole world. Now by this we know that we know him if we keep his commandments. If we hear him and do what? Listen attentively. Focus. And then follow the instructions that we're given. He who says, I know him, and does not keep his commandments, is a liar, and the truth is not in him. He who says, I know him, and doesn't do these things, they aren't really hearing him. right? They're not really hearing what he has to say. They're not really paying attention. But, verse 5, whoever keeps his word, truly the love of God is perfected in him. Because the love of God is described by not killing somebody, but hating them. The love of God is described by not stealing somebody's property, but what? Giving to those who have need. By this we also know that we are in him. And in verse 6 specifically, he who says he abides in him, ought himself also to walk just as he walked. So when you hear what Jesus Christ has to say, you pay close attention, you're intent on what he's saying, and you're listening very carefully, and then you begin to follow what he says, that means you are abiding in him. Abiding means to stay. It's not passing. It's not momentary. Come on over to John chapter 15. John chapter 15. And let's see, let's start in verse 7. Section is talking about the vine, but breaking into the thought in verse 7, it says, if you abide in me, and my words abide in you, you will ask what you desire, and it shall be given done to you. By this is my Father glorified, that you bear much fruit, so you will be my disciples. So if you abide in me and my words abide in you. The Greek expression for words indicates Jesus' entire message. Okay? Jesus' entire message. What is the lesson for this sermon? Two words? Hear it. So you're to hear his entire message. What he brings forth for us. The disciples, and true disciples, do more than just believe what Jesus says. They let Jesus' words abide in them. I mean, even Satan, what? What does it say about Satan? Yeah, he knew the scriptures. He knew what Jesus Christ, he heard him, he knew, but did he abide? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. As a matter of fact, if you look at verse 3, it says that the words of Jesus Christ cleansed them. They were washed by the words of God as well, not just the blood. So Jesus is equating abiding in him with abiding in his words, his teachings, his listening, or our listening to what he has to say. It's more than words. How do we let Jesus' words abide in us? The word abide implies intimate knowledge of what a person has said. But it also implies that the words become a vital part of the way a believer lives. Okay? Abiding isn't just hearing, it means it becomes a part of who you are. And it's a vital part of the way a believer lives. So Jesus' words abide in us when we know what he said and did, and what? When we allow those words and the actions to affect the way we live. Then we can say that Christ and his words abide in us. So by reading and memorizing, how many of you have memory scriptures? Your memory card. Some of you may have bought them from ABC, okay? Some of you, I have mine from way back in Ambassador College. When you memorize the scriptures and you can bring them to mind and you hear what is said through the eyes and then you live by those words, you are abiding. So by reading and memorizing, we take God's word in, and then by obeying, we indicate that the words abide in us. Okay, they live in us. Now how? How can we take these words? Let me give you five elements to think about, okay? Number one, we learn from Jesus' actions and teachings. We learn from Jesus' actions and teachings what to do. Right? We learn from his actions and his teachings what to do. Two, we learn from his responses what? Don't make it too complicated. We learn from Jesus Christ's responses, which we can read of in the harmony, for instance. We learn how we should respond. I don't know how to respond to that well. How did Jesus respond? You can usually find something where you can apply the principle, right? On how you should respond. Number three. We learn from Jesus Christ's compassion what? How we should love. How we should love. The one thing that really jumped out at me the very first year that I focused on the harmony of the Gospels was how often that you read all four of these accounts and how often the word compassion is used and how often it says Jesus was moved with compassion. Jesus was moved with compassion because of the widow. Moved with compassion because of the dead son. He was moved with compassion because of the lepers. He was moved with continually was moved with compassion. If Christ's words abide in us, in his, how he lived his life, then we learn from that. Because we hear attentively, and then we apply it. So we learn from Jesus Christ's compassion how we should love others. We learn from his obedience. Christ was very obedient. We learn from his obedience how we should submit to the Father. How we should submit to the Father. And then we learn from his self-control. Christ was very self-controlled. That comes out vividly through the harmony of the Gospel. We learn from his self-control how we can stay pure and strong. That's why it's important to listen to hear what he has to say. Now, verse 9, in John chapter 15. I really like the way the word abide is used here. Verse 9 says, as the Father loved me, I also have loved you. And then what does he say? Abide in my love. Oh, don't just stay a little while. Don't let it be momentary. Abide means staying for a while, lasting. Abide in my love. Now, my wife and I do marriage workshops, and I cover this in particular, this section with regard to husbands and wives. I said, wouldn't it be awesome if every husband and every wife told each other, sweetheart, I just want you to abide in my love. How would you ladies love to hear your husband say, sweetheart, I really would like to have you just abide in my love. Are you men hearing it from your wives? As opposed to, I just want you to abide in my anger. No, there's a difference. Christ says he wants us to abide in his love. After all, God says, his definition is what? God is love. He wants us to abide in his love. Abiding means stay. If you go back to verse 4 and 5, it says, for the Son to love us in the same way that the Father loves him means we receive the greatest love possible. Isn't that what it says in verse verse 7? Yeah. We receive the greatest love possible. Now, come on over to verse 10, just one more verse down. It says, if you keep my commandments, you will abide in my love. So he doesn't just give us statements. He also tells you what? The how-to. How to accomplish it. So if you keep my commandments, you will abide in my love, just as I have kept my Father's commandments and I abide in his love. And then he says in verse 11, these things have I spoken to you, that my joy may remain, not passing, but remain in you, and that your joy may be full. Something else that we bring out in a marriage workshop. If a husband or a wife would say to the other, sweetheart, I want to live and I want to help your joy to be full. I want to make your life joyful as opposed to I want to make your life a living hell. Yet too often people feel like they're living where? In hell. It's unfortunate. But God says, no, or Christ says, I want your joy to be full. That's something that we should apply when it comes to just normal life that we live. Because that's why God gives it to us. Now, Turn over to John chapter 10. We'll wrap this up. You're going to get out early today. I know you really will not like that, but we're going to do it anyway. John chapter 10. John chapter 10. And we will pick the story up, specifically in verse 10. This is the section of Scripture talks about the Good Shepherd. You know, we hear His voice. We know who He is because we want hear Him. I know you're probably tired of hearing that, but hopefully one thing you will get out of the sermon is I should hear Christ, right? Which means I should pay attention. I should listen to. I should be really focused, and then I should follow the instruction that I'm given, or I should obey Him. Right? We obey Him, we abide in His love. In verse 10, I'm sorry, chapter 10, where it talks about, again, Jesus Christ being the Good Shepherd, talks about the door coming in and going out. Verse 9 of chapter 10 says, I am the door. If anyone enters by me, he will be saved, and will go in and out and find pasture. That's what God wants for us. Because, verse 10, it says, the thief does not come except to steal. And he comes to kill. And he comes to destroy. But I have come. Remember, He's the one that came and He's spoken to us. God has spoken to us through His Son now. I have come that they may have life and that they may have it more abundantly. Now, if He came that we may have life more abundantly, it seems like He knows how to attain that life. Would you not agree? I would say Jesus Christ knows how to attain an abundant life. He knows how to attain it. Therefore, it behooves us to pay attention to His teachings and follow His instructions if we want to have what? An abundant life. So when God says through this voice, hear Him, why is He wanting you to hear it? Is He wanting you to hear Him because He's on an ego trip? Hear Him, pay attention. You know, there are people like that. You will listen to me and you will obey me. You will. You guys are on an ego trip. If you read through the harmony of the Gospels and all the Bible about leadership, you know, Christ says, it shall not be so among you. I'm a very firm believer that anyone who has an authoritarian approach to life when it comes to leadership should never be in a leadership position. Never. I don't care how talented the person is. If he is an authoritarian, he should never be in a leadership position. Christ said that. It shall not so be among you. Doesn't mean that you're not authoritative, that you have knowledge and understanding and you're willing to fulfill the job you have. But no authoritarian, in my opinion, get that on tape, my opinion, should have a leadership position. Because he will abuse those, or she will abuse those serving. It's just unfortunate, axiomatic. So the lesson that we covered at the ABC Continuing Education that was fundamental and foundation to everything else, the other 3 points I covered, lessons to learn from the harmony, is listen, pay attention, follow the instructions, in other words, hear Him.